Should federal aid to education be expanded? That is the question. This is America United, the informal discussion program heard on the NBC network each week at this time. Today's question will be discussed by spokesmen for labor, business, agriculture, and the teaching profession. Host today is the National Grange, represented here by J.T. Sanders. Our other guests, Miss Selma Borchard of the American Federation of Labor, Francis J. Brown of the American Council on Education, and Paul H. Good of the United States Chamber of Commerce. Our moderator is David Brinkley, NBC Washington commentator. Mr. Brinkley.
Included in the long list of legislation President Truman recommended to this Congress, the 81st, was a program of aid by the federal government to the states, aid in the improvement of state school systems. The idea is to see that children going to school in relatively poor states get education equal to that of children in wealthier states. This Congress so far has not decided the issue one way or another, so while it's pending, a discussion today by four people well-versed in the problem, a discussion of whether this plan for federal government aid to state schools is a good idea or a bad one. So we hope you will listen to their opinions and make up your own mind. To start our discussion, I'm going around our round table and ask each of our four guests to tell us, first of all, very briefly, how he feels about today's question, should federal aid to education be expanded? I'll start with Mr. Brown of the American Council on Education. Mr. Brown?
I'm very glad that the question is phrased, should federal aid to education be expanded? Because it implies what is a fact, that the federal government is already assisting in the support of education at various levels and in many kinds of ways. The American Council on Education and those of us on the staff of the council are in favor of the extension of federal aid to education for a number of reasons. One is that it is a logical extension of the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution, a very elastic clause which has broadened to include not only highways and flood control and agricultural extension, but now hospital conservation and operation, research and disease control, public health services, school health services, school lunch, and many more. A second reason that we favor it is that it broadens the basis of tax support for education, a trend which has expanded from the local school district to the state, and now logically to the federal government. And the third and perhaps most obvious reason is that it will equalize educational opportunity for all children in a highly mobile population in which the education of a child in one state is the welfare not of the state but of the nation.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Good of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States.
The National Chamber believes that adequate education is essential to the maintenance of our democratic institutions and to the expansion of our economy. We believe that wherever inadequate educational facilities exist, proper additional expenditure should be made to improve them. The National Chamber has, for a number of years, urged all of its member bodies, both state and local chambers, to promote improved support for education at both the state and local levels. And these are not idle words, as there are now over 1,300 education committees widely scattered among the 48 states, wherein laymen and educators are working together on their state and local education problems. There are those who would transfer today this responsibility in part to the federal government. They would establish a new principle of paying current operating costs of our schools. They would be willing to start with, say, a $300 million appropriation, with the intent of building the fund to, let's say, $2 billion or more during the next few years. Now I think we're in substantial agreement with the recognized educational leaders on the real immediate needs of education. First would be the shortage of school housing, due, of course, to the increased birth rate. Second, a need for qualified elementary teachers. But the bills before Congress at this time are supposed to equalize educational opportunity it's difficult for us to see just how these bills meet either one of these particular needs.
Thank you. Now, Miss Borchard of the American Federation of Labor.
The American Federation of Labor has, since it was formally established, worked for the growth and betterment of the American public school system. In fact, before the AFL was founded, the trade unions of America made the establishment of the free public school one of its essential purposes. Labor wants federal aid for education, which will actually help equalize educational opportunity. For through such equalization will come the growth of our democratic process. I'm glad that Dr. Brown spoke about the welfare clause, because we in the labor movement recognize that through the welfare clause, and indeed through the 16th Amendment, we may equitably share in the nation's wealth. Labor wants federal aid, which will, first, help the states maintain good public schools. Second, afford every child those services through which his health, welfare, and social being, as well as his mental capacities, are best developed. Third, promote a sound building program under state control. And fourth, aid needy students and youth remain in school. And fifth, remove adult illiteracy.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Sanders of the National Grange.
Mr. Brinkley and members of the panel, the Grange has, since it is a farm organization, of course, has always been strong for education, especially of rural districts. We recognize that probably our weakest link in our public school system is the rural schools. We are highly in favor, therefore, of federal aid to education. We would limit that federal aid to the constitutional provisions which provide that control of education must always rest in the states and in the local communities. Now, Mr. Brown said that he favored this because it broadens the basis of taxation, and Mr. Good said that he thought that this introduced a new principle of school support. We don't believe it introduced a new principle of school support. We believe that it only implements a fundamental principle that has been recognized all along, that local communities cannot necessarily educate their children to an equivalent standard of other communities that are very much richer, that states have to equalize the burden of taxation, and it is just as logical and economically sound that the federal government help to equalize this burden. And that will be the principal thing I want to emphasize as the discussion proceeds, namely that it is economically sound that the federal government help to equalize the burden of education in this country of ours.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sanders. Maybe we could profitably begin our discussion with this point. Is there a need for federal aid to education, and if so, why? Who'd like to answer that for us? Mr. Brown, could you tell us?
The statistics have been presented many times in the contrast of the economic income by states and their expenditures for education. For example, Mississippi, as contrasted with New York State, spends a larger proportion of its economic income for education and yet provides less than half the expenditure per school child than does New York State. Certainly, when one compares the economic ability of states to pay for education, there is a need. Other statistics might be presented or information given, perhaps by other members of the panel, on the educational level in the states at the present time when they are supported solely on a statewide basis.
Mr. Sanders?
Mr. Brinkley, on that point, I don't recall in reading the testimony given before the various committees a single individual that denied the great need for a greater equalization of the educational opportunities. And I believe we could spend a great deal of our time here doing something that is probably It may be unnecessary because everybody recognizes that there are great inequalities in our present educational system and that there most certainly is a great need for equalizing it. The question would be whether the federal government should do the equalization or not, and I maintain that it is economically sound and absolutely economically necessary for the federal government to step in and equalize the burdens.
Mr. Good, can you comment on that?
Yes, I'd be very happy to. Going back pre-war, the statements particularly of proponents of federal aid being made that states are doing all that they can do to provide for education, or that low-income states are the states that are providing the greatest percent of their income. Well, now, if we want to use the U.S. Office of Education figures, we find that prior to the war, there were just 16 states spending more than 3% of their income for education. There were two states spending more than 4%, up to 4 2/25%. Of these 16 states, only two were in the Southeast, where we have particularly our low-income states. And then during that same period, when we only had 11 states spending more than 2%, that is, of last year. In fact, there wasn't a state in the Union spending 3% of its income last year, according to the figures put out by the Committee, Educational Finance Act of 1929. This is the committee in the Senate, the figures I'm quoting from. Only 11 of those states were spending more than 2%, so there was not last year a single state spending even 3% of its income. Now, what's going to happen to the initiative in these states and local communities if you stifle their initiative? For example, if a state was willing to spend 4 2/25% of its income prior to the war, and then when we consider the incomes up, particularly in the Southeast today, up three times what they were pre-war, isn't it reasonable to assume that a state can spend at least the same percent of its income today that it could pre-war without hurting itself?
You say then that states could do a great deal to improve their own schools by spending a larger part of their incomes.
They were willing to do so prior to the war. Why have they not been willing to do so since?
Miss Borchard, can you
I certainly agree with Mr. Good that the states should do a great deal more. And we feel that the states should have that social consciousness, which we in the labor movement are going to try and get into the state legislatures to have them do it. Now, our conception of federal aid is that it will stimulate the states. In other words, we don't want a matching because the states simply cannot match there. That would not in any way equalize opportunity. But we want to have the states made to maintain their educational budget, to maintain their a percentage of contribution from their income, and made to keep up the teachers' salary level they now have. In other words, the federal government says, if you work to your full capacity, we'll help you serve the United States. Now, I know you may say that's control, but that's the kind of control, not of curricula, but to make the states exercise their initiative is the kind of control we want.
Mr. Good?
I would like to point out to Ms. Borchard that, for example, of recent date, the Kentucky teachers failed to approve a sales tax in their state because they were looking first to see whether they get federal aid to education.
Well, if they were trade unionists, they'd oppose it anyhow.
Well, I submit that that, of course, is stifling their own initiative. Then I'm interested in a superintendent of schools who came into our office quite recently from one of these states, which would be one of the larger recipients under this bill. We talked about the whole financing problem for some little period of time, and he finally said, well, I think we're likely to get some federal aid. I've been over to one of the other offices here in Washington proposing that it's all favorable to federal aid. He said, you know, we just passed a $1 million bond issue down in our community for a new junior high school. He said, I believe I'll have to go back and tell our people to wait, that we'd better not spend that money. And then I had to tell the gentleman that, unfortunately, you couldn't even spend this federal money for school construction, which he said was their greatest need today.
Mr. Sanders?
Frankly, we... We recognize all that Mr. Good has said is true, that the states could spend more. But we in the Grange don't want to use that as an excuse to keep us from supporting federal aid. I can give him a much better thing to excuse himself from supporting federal aid than that. For example, last year, Mr. Good, we spent $9 billion on liquor. I think it would be better for us not to spend so much liquor and support our schools more liberally. But that isn't an excuse for not supporting our schools. We must get the federal government to help equalize this burden because, as I said before, it's economically sound. And I want to give some facts later to indicate that it is economically sound.
And right. Socially essential.
Mr. Brown?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was going to say that Mr. Good is using, I think, exceptional instances and generalizing on them, which is always an effective argument, but not necessarily sound. Certainly, the data indicate pretty clearly that the states and the municipalities are expanding their expenditures for education with or without federal aid. And we come back again to the basic issue as to whether the federal government should share in that expansion.
Mr. Barden and the House committee, where the hearings are now being held, made the statement Thursday of last week that the states could do this job. He said he admitted it. He said his only feeling was that the states hadn't done quite what they should do, and that he was fearful they would not do what he wanted them to do.
Well, I think now, there's another issue involved in that, very definitely. The states could do the job, but if they were to do the job, there should be a very definite and immediate reversal of the trend of public taxation. If you recognize that at the present time, 85 cents out of every dollar raised in public tax goes into the federal treasury, then that priority of tax also carries with it a responsibility for benefits.
Well, that's why
Would you go along with that, Mr. Good?
Oh, absolutely. I'm quite sure that that's very accurate, Mr. Brown. But the difficulty is, of course, that we're all looking to the federal government now. And when we see what happened in foreign countries, the field of education in Germany, Czechoslovakia, Russia, are we willing to take that chance in this country? Are we going to eventually be spending such a high percent of our income for education? Now, wait a minute. I don't mean a high percent of our income. I mean a high percent of our income at the federal level for education, that we may run into a real danger.
Well,
you, Miss Borchard?
I'm amazed to find that you feel that by putting more money into education that we run the risk of turning totalitarian. On the contrary.
No, I didn't
say
that.
The inference to me would be that you refer to Russia, which does have a much greater appropriation for education than we have in the other states. But take Great Britain, which has really a magnificent social reconstruction through the educational process. And we'd like to see our people made thoroughly aware of their social responsibilities in a democracy through education, and that's why we want the federal government to help the states.
Mr. Sanders wants to say
now
something.
Now, I just must get my figures in here on economic justification for the federal government. The farms of this country contribute a 500,000 boys and girls that they educate at their own expense and give to the cities. Most of them go to New York, Philadelphia, and places like that. That costs the farmers of this country billions and billions of dollars over the course of 10 years. Now, that's one very sound economic justification for redistributing this. How are you going to support those states that give those boys to cities unless you do it through the federal government? The second justification is that our whole economic structure concentrates wealth and income in our big urban centers. I worked once for a company in New York that had over 20,000 people, the top man getting something like $150,000, yet that income came from every hamlet, every county, every state of this union. How are you going to redistribute such concentration of income and taxing power unless you do it federally?
Mr. Good?
I would say that if you have studied the equalization of regional economies over a period of the last 20 years, you'll see that the Southeast and a grain belt section of which, in the area which I formerly lived, has been moving up rapidly. And the Northeastern and the highly industrialized states have been moving downward as a percent of their national average
income. That won't hold true for cities, though, as contrasted to urban districts. The urban districts have been moving up gradually and will continue to move up gradually.
Well, let's take the whole state of North Dakota, which is quite agricultural, isn't it? North Dakota, you know, is now third in the nation in per capita income. That surprises a great many people. Yet under this federal aid appropriation, North Dakota would take out a great sum of money. It doesn't look to us like a state that ranks third highest in income in the nation.
Mr. Good
should
is calling to us
a great sum of money from this.
Mr. Good is calling our attention to a purely temporary phenomenon. He knows that that is based on high-priced wheat, which cannot persist.
I don't know. With government support, it's likely to persist, is it not?
Well,
no.
The price of wheat is an interesting point. Maybe we can talk about that another day. But let's get back for a moment to the question of federal aid. Let's assume...
Well, may I ask Mr. Good, he quotes Mr. Barden, who says that the states could do more but won't do more. I would quote Mr. Barden on the other way, that Mr. Barden is trying to have legislation which wouldn't require the states to maintain any of the safeguards for keeping up their own payments. You see, we in the trade union movement want those very safeguards in the legislation, which Mr. Barden, whom you quote, wants removed from the legislation.
We're between the horns of a dilemma, then, aren't we?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Mr. Barden we're talking about, I believe, is a representative from North Carolina. Is that right?
That's correct.
And is chairman of the committee that has the bill in the House.
Well, what about the general idea of a program of federal aid to education? How would it be handled? How would it be administered? Who would get the money and how much and on what basis? Who can tell us that? Mr. Brown, can you?
Well, the basic legislation would leave the funds in the hands of the state to spend without controls from the federal government. Now, there are bills that differ in their points of view on that very question, but I think everyone has agreed on the general principle that the funds should be distributed as far as possible on a formula that recognizes need and should be left then to the state for the for its own expenditure in the light of its own need.
Letting the state decide for itself
how
it's
spent. Letting the state make the basic decisions.
Mr. Good, would you...
Well, of course, I think there are far fewer controls in Mr. Barden's bill than there are in the other Senate bill. But, of course, there is the control in there where the money must be spent for current operating costs when the real need today is many areas for school construction. We get that statement, of course, from school leaders themselves. I think we ought to remind ourselves...
Oh, well, may I say that I consider, perhaps because I talk from the point of view of the human element in it, I consider the teacher just as important as the building. And as Senator Hill said, the American teacher is the vanishing creature in America today. And we know that recruitment is almost impossible. And... of course, we in the labor movement definitely want a major percentage, 75% of the money used for the payment of public school teachers' salaries and the remainder for services for all children. But to say that the building is the only need, we want a building program. But certainly current expenditures for teacher salaries are very important.
No, Miss Borchardt, I didn't say that school buildings were all the need. In my original statement, I said school buildings and more elementary teachers. No, I think we ought to take a look at the figures, too. The average current expenditure, was $88 per pupil prior to the war. It has moved up to $178 now. We think it's going to go higher. We think it should. But we're only trying to stimulate local communities and states to do the job. Now, let me ask one question here, if I may.
May I ask him a question right there on that?
And then, Mr. Good,
he quite well knows that the $170 now would pay for just about as much as 88 pre-war.
Well, the cost of living index...
There's no advance in our educational standards, therefore.
The cost of living index, I believe, is up 0.69, and you can see that this is above that
pre-war
expenditure. Now, the cost of living index is up 0.69. Now, my question is...
Since when?
I don't know what's his base. He's talking from some base that must be pretty high, not the base that I usually compare.
Educational expenditures have kept pace with the cost of living index. That's my point. I'm not saying that teachers' salaries are too high. We don't think they are. We never have thought so. I'd like to ask this question. How can you reconcile the $5 per school child in the bill, to pay that back in every state. I'd like to have Mr. Brown make a statement on
I'd
that.
Like to answer that.
Well, we'll hear
even
from Mr. Sanders and Mr. Brown.
But as an agriculturalist, there isn't a state in this union that doesn't have some subnormal rural schools. And that would help to do that.
Well, we certainly share that point of view.
Yes, that was exactly what I was going to say, that it would raise the level of education in all states, and yet at the same time would raise the level in the states of greatest need to the greatest extent.
Exactly.
I think that is
certainly true. Two principles go together.
What about the question of controls? That quite often comes up in discussions of this kind. Is there any fear in anyone's mind that a program of federal aid might lead to federal control?
There's no reason why it should. The pattern of federal aid for education thus far, the GI Bill, the vocational education, the land-grant colleges, there's been absolutely no attempt to control curricula. Then why should there be a departure from the traditional program?
I should like to tie that back, Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Good's statement a moment ago when he cited some of the European countries and indicated that support brings with it control. It is not who pays the bill that determines the control of education. It's within what framework of thinking is that support given. And as Ms. Borchardt pointed out, England and Holland and many more of the countries, democratic to the extreme, are now paying the bulk of their educational bills through the federal government and with no controls. And I should just like to lay low that argument about control and support going hand in hand without recognizing the principle back of the whole idea.
Some of the greatest educational leaders in history, and one great educational leader, I think we'll say today, had this statement. In fact, I'm quoting now from General Eisenhower's inaugural address when he said, "A paternalistic government can gradually destroy by suffocation in the immediate advantage of subsidy, the will of a people to maintain a high degree of individual responsibility. And the abdication of individual responsibility is inevitably followed by further concentration of power in the state." And I'd like to add to that, if I may, Benjamin Fine's article in Monday, May 23rd, New York Times, where he says, "Educators, with $3.4 billion U.S. aid for 49, see vast waste in duplication by bureaus. They fear for independence."
Mr. Sanders?
Mr. Good's statement there, if you use that logic to its ultimate purity, you would say schools must be supported entirely by the local district and give the utmost dependence on the local people. And it is so far from the things that we're seeking to use that argument against federal aid. We are trying to give federal aid, but leave the control in the hands of the state and the local government, and that can be done. It's been done over and over again, and it can be done in the
right.
I'm sorry I have to interrupt at this point, because before we go, I want to summarize very briefly the differing opinions we've heard today. Mr. Brown of the American Council on Education says federal aid already exists and it should be expanded. He says it fits under the general welfare clause of the Constitution and would equalize schooling for all children regardless of where they are. Mr. Good of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States says, of course, adequate education is essential and it needs improvement in many places, but he believes it is a job primarily for the states and not the federal government. Ms. Borchardt of the AF&L agrees generally with Mr. Brown. She favors federal education for the same reasons. Mr. Sanders of the Grange says rural schools are the weakest link in our national school system, and he believes federal aid would be a fine way to improve them. Thanks to the four of you. Here is Jack Roney.
This has been America United, the informal discussion program heard on the NBC network each week at this time. Speaking today were Ms. Selma Borchardt of the American Federation of Labor, Francis J. Brown of the American Council on Education, Paul H. Good of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States, and J.T. Sanders speaking for our host, the National Grange. Our moderator was David Brinkley, NBC Washington commentator. Printed copies of today's forum may be had without cost by writing to the National Grange, Washington 6, D.C. This program is brought to you by the NBC Network and its independent affiliated stations. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.